I'd like to welcome everyone here to session number 363, Mormons and the Iraq War, the Sunstone Symposium 2008. We are going to have a presenter and then a respondent. But before I introduce them, I would like to ask everyone right now to turn off any noisemaker they might have with them or think they might have. Any phones or buzzers or anything like that. And I also want to remind people that there will be a copy of this session that they can buy out in front desk after a short while after the session is over. Okay. Our presenter is Will Van Wagenen. Will graduated from BYU with a degree in German and from Harvard Divinity School with a master's degree in theological studies, and he served a mission to Frankfurt, Germany. He has recently returned from Iraq, where he worked for 7 months for a human rights organization called Christian Peacemaker Teams. He also traveled with Christian Peacemaker Teams to Colombia. He is active in Mormons for Equality and Social Justice and is the founder of the progressive LDS news magazine, The Mormon Worker. You can get a copy of The Mormon Worker in the bookstore, and I did. And it looks like this. So afterwards, you can go into the bookstore and get a copy. Our respondent is J. Bonner Ritchie. J. Bonner Ritchie is well known to Sunstone people. He's a professor emeritus of organizational behavior at BYU. He's a consultant, a peacemaker, a lecturer who has taught at several universities in the Middle East. And he is a member of the Sunstone Board of Directors. He was called to build bridges to the Palestinian people. And he is working on a project restructuring the educational system in Jordan. We have an exciting session for you, and I'll turn the time over to Will.
Okay, well, thanks everyone for coming, of course. It's always nice to have a few people show up when you're going to have to speak. So, first off, I'll just say a few things about both the war on terror and the war in Iraq, and kind of talk about that from the perspective of the Book of Mormon specifically. And I'll try to keep that rather brief, and then try to, after that, just tell some stories and some experiences that I had while I was working in Iraq, just to make a few different points, and hopefully that'll be interesting. And then, of course, after that, Bonner will say some things. So, first off, with the war on terror, the one thing that, I mean, there's a lot of disturbing things about it, but one thing that was quite disturbing was the way in which the Bush administration basically said, we're going to go on the offensive, and started saying things like the following. This is a quote from Dick Cheney, where he said, "The war against terror won't end in a treaty or negotiations with the terrorists, but will end only in their complete and utter destruction." So, as Mormons, that should be disturbing to us, because there's a passage in Mormon, this is chapter 3, where Mormon criticizes the fact that the Nephites did swear by the heavens and also by the throne of God that they would go up to battle against their enemies and would cut them off from the face of the land. "And it came to pass that I, Mormon, did utterly refuse from this time forth to be a commander and leader of this people." Later on, when things get worse, the Nephites are on the verge of extinction. Mormon kind of changes his mind and goes back to leading the Nephite armies again. But this is an indication that, you know, if we're trying to use the Book of Mormon as a guide for how we should, whether we should support or oppose the war on terror, my sense is from this passage in Scripture, when you're swearing to utterly destroy your enemies, number one, it's not a very Christian thing to say when you take all the things that Jesus said into account in the Sermon on the Mount. And secondly, you know, Mormon, the general Mormon himself said that this is, it's basically wicked to do this and to make those kind of oaths and to fight out of revenge and so on and so forth. So that's one thing. The other thing is, with the Iraq War in specific, even though Iraq, of course, had nothing to do with 9/11, the Bush administration vowed that they were going to, destroy all of the terrorists. And to them, that included, the Iraqi government. And again, as Mormons often hear people making, kind of looking back at the story of Captain Moroni and saying, well, of course, look, we're fighting for the sake of freedom and for our families and for our religion. And so, if we go and invade Iraq and kill all these terrorists, they hate freedom, et cetera, et cetera. This fits perfectly with what it says in the Book of Mormon. Look at Captain Moroni. He was this great war hero. And, unfortunately, what people miss in that, I don't know if they're just remembering that story from Sunday school when they were 10 years old and they've never really bothered to read the Book of Mormon. But if you actually look at all those war chapters starting in Alma 43 that go to about Alma 62, you'll notice that the only time in which Moroni is actually fighting, again, for the homes of the Nephites, for their wives, for their children, for their religion, etc., it's in the context of their lands being invaded by the Lamanites. And you have, for example, two different Lamanite kings, Zerahemna and also Amalickiah, who, basically it says they stir up the Lamanites to anger against the Nephites and then end up invading Nephite land. Well, this was a little bit harder, to notice when the war started. I was saying things like this to all my friends, etc., but it was harder, for people to accept at the time. But of course, now it's quite easy to notice or perceive that President Bush did basically the same thing that Amalickiah did. He stirred up the hearts of Americans to anger against the Iraqis in order to get public support for his war against Iraq. Again, even though they had never attacked us and had nothing to do with 9/11, President Bush and the administration led Americans to believe that Iraq was involved, led them to believe that there were weapons of mass destruction. And of course, we now, years later, it's of course quite clear that they were basically just lying. So there's a very close parallel there between President Bush and the behavior of people like Zerahemnah and Amalickiah, these kings of the Lamanites that were continually trying to invade Nephite lands. So again, the main mistake that people make when they say, look, we as the Americans, we're fighting for freedom and our homes and our lands and our religion, is that they read the Book of Mormon, and because the Nephites, it's written from a Nephite perspective, we, reading it, automatically identify with the Nephites. We kind of think of ourselves as the modern-day Nephites. Now, when thinking about the war, because all of the information we get about the war is, by watching CNN, Fox, etc., and reading the New York Times and Washington Post, it's always from an American perspective, and we're, of course, Americans, so we see the war through that lens. And we think to ourselves, we as Americans are the Nephites here, and the Iraqis, of course, are the Lamanites. But in fact, it's the exact opposite. Again, the United States invaded Iraq, and that right there makes U.S. involvement in Iraq, basically illegitimate from a Book of Mormon perspective. And at the same time, even though we view Iraqis who fight against U.S. troops in Iraq as terrorists and all these different things, they, from a Book of Mormon perspective, are the ones who, in fact, are fighting for their homes, for their wives, for their lands, for their religion, and so on and so forth. In fact, there's one quote here from Alma where it talks about how the Nephites were doing that which they felt was their duty to God by fighting against the invading Lamanites. And, you know, if you look in Islam and if you read a little bit in the Quran, you can find a lot of passages which basically say that Muslims should do the same thing. I'll just give you a couple examples. It says here in the second chapter, the 190th verse of the Quran, it says, "And fight in the way of Allah, or God, with those who fight with you, and do not exceed the limits." Just fight in self-defense. Here's another one. "Permission to fight is given to those upon whom war is made, because they are oppressed, and most surely Allah is well able to assist them." The same thing. If someone fights against you, you have permission to fight back at them. And this is the same type of thing that that Moroni was doing. You also notice that, you know, in Iraq, a lot of the groups who are fighting against the U.S. military, they don't only fight against the U.S. military, they fight against Iraqis who are collaborating with the Americans, namely those Iraqis who have joined the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army and so on and so forth. And, for example, here's a quote from a very famous Sunni cleric named Harith Adari, who is the head of the Muslim Scholars Association, which is a Sunni religious organization in Iraq that has close ties to the Sunni insurgency. And this religious organization is kind of like the political face of the Iraqi resistance, or these different Sunni insurgent groups. And this is what Harith Adari said about, you know, the issue of who is it okay to target, who is it okay to kill, since we're trying to fight against these invading Americans. And he said, "We and others like us recognize the legitimacy of resistance and the right of nations to resist against their enemies and occupiers." Again, this is Captain Moroni's position. He said, we and all those who think like us believe that resistance should be against the occupying enemies and their obvious agents that cooperate with, support, and fight with the occupiers. So again, they're talking about the new Iraqi police and army that the United States recruited to fight against the Iraqi insurgency on behalf of the United States, which is a big reason for the cause of the civil war that has been going on there for a long time. And I'll talk more about the aspects of civil war in a bit. He says, now he's talking about, you know, killing civilians. He says, "Those who target innocent and peaceful Iraqis from all sects, denominations, and faiths are condemned criminals that trespass against Islamic jurisprudence and are outside the law and the national values. They are like the enemies and occupiers of the homeland, regardless of to which sect or faction or faith they belong." So this is the position of the vast majority of the resistance groups who are fighting against the United States in Iraq, as opposed to Al-Qaeda, for example, who, you know, have no issue in killing civilians. These groups say it's legitimate to fight the occupiers who have invaded our country, and it's legitimate to fight against their agents or the Iraqis who are working with them. And killing civilians, whether you're an American or you're a Muslim, it doesn't matter. That's criminal, and that's wrong. So there are all these other instances where Captain Moroni puts to death different people. For example, the Kingmen, in those same chapters in Alma, start a rebellion. They try to take over the government, and you know they're not able to do that. And Captain Moroni basically takes his marches his armies back to the capital to assist Bahoran in putting down this rebellion. Again, this is in the context of a Lamanite invasion. The Kingmen are collaborating with the invading Lamanites, and Captain Moroni puts to death about 4,000 people. Okay, so again, everything that these Iraqi resistance groups, Al-Qaeda aside, it's a different story, they are behaving in the exact same way that Captain Moroni behaved. So, again, for us as Mormons, if you take the Book of Mormon as a guide, there's no argument, there's no justification for supporting the Iraq War, supporting the U.S. military invading the country of Iraq. And in fact, you know, you'll notice that constantly, Captain Moroni, in fact, he writes a letter to the king of the Lamanites later on, where he basically says, you know, if you don't withdraw, put down your weapons and withdraw from Nephite lands and go back to your own lands, we will basically keep fighting and, you know, we'll defeat you. And that is the exact demand that all of the different Iraqi resistance groups are making of the United States. There's this sense that, you know, if we withdraw from Iraq, then suddenly there will be, you know, if we don't fight them there in Iraq, then we'll be fighting them in New York and so on and so forth. And that's just simply wrong. The groups in Iraq that are fighting against the United States, that is their main demand, is that the United States withdraw and simply go back to where they came from. And that, you know, would be the end of the conflict. So, again, I would just encourage us to somehow, some way, get away from the idea that it's good for America to win the war in Iraq. That's a very common view amongst Democrats. They'll say, well, you know, President Bush, you know, number one, he lied and went in there. There were no weapons, and they lied, and we invaded anyways. But you know what? We're there, and so we need to win. And they'll criticize President Bush for, you know, making mistakes, doing a bad job, and so on and so forth. But for Democrats, they still want to win the war. And we, as Mormons, need to take an international approach, or basically say, look, all people are children of God. There's nothing better about America. There's no reason that America should conquer these countries and be victorious and so on and so forth. Whatever the situation is, we need to look at it, look at our Mormon values that are taught in our scriptures, and whoever is deserving of support, we should give that, and whoever is not deserving of support, you know, we should withdraw it. There's another very interesting you know, story in those same chapters in Alma, and that is when the king of the Lamanites, Zerahemnah, was doing the same thing, stirring up the Lamanites to anger against the Nephites and was trying to basically invade Nephite lands again. He basically institutes a draft. He calls up all the Lamanites and says, you know, everyone needs to gather together, you know, for the sake of invading the Nephites. And there's actually a group of Lamanites who refuse to essentially be drafted and come and join the campaign to fight against the Nephites. And because these Lamanites are rebelling against the this group of Lamanites is rebelling against the Lamanite king and they won't go to war, that's when the king, Zerahemnah, has to appoint Amalickiah, who previously had been a Nephite, who's a Nephite dissenter, that's when he appoints Amalickiah as head of the armies to go and basically put down this rebellion and force this group of Lamanites to, you know, join the army again and go and fight the Nephites. And so they actually appoint someone as their leader, and his name was Lahonti. Has anyone ever heard that name before? Does anyone recall that story? Okay, got one person nodding his head. That, to me, is a really great example of, you know, what we as Mormons should be doing when the President of the United States, like the King of the Lamanites, says, hey, we're going to go invade this country who's never done anything to us. We as Latter-day Saints should basically be saying, we're not going to participate. We're not going to do it. You know, how would that be if the Utah National Guard just basically sent a letter to President Bush saying the war is wrong, it's a war of aggression, we're not going to participate, and you're going to have to send, you know, basically the U.S. military to come and force us as the Utah National Guard to go to war if that's what you want us to do. So, again, from a Book of Mormon perspective, these would be, you know, appropriate actions. Moving away from the Book of Mormon stuff, did I forget one of my pieces of paper? Sorry. Again, I'm going to try and move into some personal experiences from being in Iraq, but I'm going to start reading a letter to the editor of the BYU newspaper. This is written by Sergeant Kyle Grodigat, who was from the 321st Engineers Division, who is from Springville and also, you know, a BYU student. And the BYU newspaper invited him to, you know, write an article, like a full-length opinion piece. And it's an article to which I responded just by writing a letter to the editor, which the BYU newspaper published after that. But let me just read through this, and then in the course of reading through the letter, you know, I'll tell some personal experiences. This soldier says, in reading some recent letters to the editor, I think we as BYU students are forgetting, like the rest of the country already has, why we are engaged in the war on terror. People have forgotten the tears shed on September 11th like it was just a scene from some old movie. Once again, September 11th had nothing to do with Iraq. Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th. It'd be as if, you know, Canada invaded Mexico and the Mexican army retaliated against the United States. Think if the Mexican people or the Mexican army and government as a whole could not distinguish between the fact that Canada is one country with one culture and one national interest and foreign policy, etc., and the United States is an entirely different country. In fact, even more so than that, Iraq and Afghanistan, they don't even speak the same language. Ethnically, they're not the same. The only thing that they do have in common is Islam, and the form of Islam practiced in both countries is totally different. But in this fellow's eyes, that's a legitimate reason to invade Iraq. He goes on to say, we have forgotten what it felt like when the sense of security we had was ripped away from us on that fateful day. And, you know, having lived in Iraq, I didn't live in the green zone. I was living just in a regular neighborhood called Karada, which was across the river from the green zone. And I was working for a human rights organization. We were basically just trying to help Iraqis locate their family members who had been detained in the different American prisons. And, you know, one thing that, you know, I obviously noticed by living there, we didn't have any armed guards, bodyguards, anything like that. We just drove around in regular cars that, you know, were pretty discreet. And, you know, every single night, I would go to bed and I would say my prayers and I'd say, you know, God, bless me that tomorrow I don't get kidnapped. Bless me that tomorrow, you know, there's not a bombing that kills me or maims me really bad while I'm walking down the street. Bless me that as we're driving in our car, you know, we don't run into an American convoy that, you know, thinks that we get too close to them and so that they therefore open fire and kill us. The major characteristic, or the defining characteristic of the post-2003 Iraq is a lack of security that is, you know, obviously there's lack of security for the people who tragically died in 9/11, but that sense of insecurity is what every Iraqi in the entire country, minus perhaps in the northern region of the Kurds, feels every single day. Are my kids, when they go to school, are they going to come back, or is there going to be a bombing? You know, will they get shot by the Americans or by an American contractor? Will they get kidnapped? You hear a lot about Westerners who were kidnapped in Iraq. In fact, I was kidnapped myself. And, you know, maybe some people here in Salt Lake heard about that. It was in the newspapers, etc. But there are thousands of Iraqis that get kidnapped in Iraq every single year for money. For whatever reason, most, you know, some of them get murdered, some of them get released, etc. But the point is, Iraqis who initially were somewhat happy when the United States came, because of the insecurity that's caused from both the U.S. presence there, as well as the presence of Al-Qaeda, etc., there is no security in Iraq. And that's a situation they've been living with now for 5 straight years. The next thing he says, open your eyes, let the scales fall from them, because the war we wage is a war of freedom. I remember sitting in a shop. There was this printing shop that we used to go to when we needed to get things translated, documents translated for us, etc. And we were just kind of waiting for the job to get done, and we were chatting with these, you know, with these young guys who were working there. And, you know, inevitably, conversation there has to do with politics and about the war, because there's this heavy, you know, just basically this state of depression that has come across most people in the entire country, especially in 2005 and 2006. I was there in 2005. And so this kid, you know, he was just telling me, he's like, you know, we just wish that someone or something could come and save us from this situation that we're in. And I looked at him and I said, well, I thought America already did that. And he got this just angry look on his face, like he just about wanted to kill me. And then I just kind of smiled and said, I know, man, I'm just joking. And, I mean, that is how absurd that seems to Iraqis, that idea that the United States came to save them, to liberate them. Again, a few people believed it initially, but due to the behavior of the United States military and the U.S. government since then, virtually no Iraqis feel that the United States is there to liberate them. In fact, they know that we're there for their oil. One thing I'd like to cite in support of that, there was a BBC poll that was conducted, it was about a year ago now, where it said 79% of Iraqis either strongly or somewhat oppose the U.S. military presence in Iraq. That's 53% and 26% respectively. So if the majority of Iraqis feel like we're not there to liberate them and they oppose our presence in the country, how can we say that we're liberating them, that we're bringing them democracy, when we're doing things that are directly contrary to what they want, namely that we are there? And again, in contrast, this is the main demand of the different insurgent groups, and both Sunni and Shia, is that they want a timetable for U.S. withdrawal. And that's something that, for the United States government, is not even on the table. They won't even discuss that. Moving on, it says, while I was deployed this past year in Ramadi, Iraq, I realized the reason America is fighting for others' freedom and against the terrorist threat. We are taking the fight to the terrorists instead of waiting for them to run more planes into our buildings or kill through bombs and disease. And in response to that, I remember one of our translators, his name was Azhar, he's a really cool guy, And we were having a conversation just about the situation one day, and he, one thing that was pretty puzzling to a lot of Iraqis is, why didn't the U.S. seal the borders after the war? Obviously, before the United States invaded, there was no such thing as al-Qaeda in Iraq. Iraq didn't have a terrorism problem, which is why there was security under Saddam, like I mentioned before. And even though people hated Saddam, they wished that he could even come back because of the fact that there was security and life could, be normal for them, somewhat normal for them, as long as they stayed out of politics, when Saddam was in power. And, they wished for those times when there was security. So they don't understand, how is it that the United States couldn't seal the borders and prevent these foreign al-Qaeda fighters from entering Iraq? And he basically said, the fact that the United States military is here, it acts as a magnet to draw terrorists to our country from, all these other Arab countries. And it was really upsetting to my friend Azhar that when George Bush would say, Iraq is the new front in the war on terror, and we're fighting them in Iraq, so we don't have to fight them in New York and in Washington. Basically what that means is that the value of the lives of Iraqis isn't worth as much as Americans. The U.S. is going to engage in its war against al-Qaeda, and a lot of Iraqi civilians are going to get killed in the crossfire, whether by the Americans or by al-Qaeda, and that's our preference because we don't want Americans dying. We're going to have Iraqis get killed and fight there instead of having Americans killed. And so, at root, that's a very racist approach, and that's something that President Bush has been very, very, very proud of saying, and that's something that this gentleman here, Khaled Groenigut, was very proud to say as well, is that we're taking the fight to the terrorists. Again, there's been probably a couple hundred thousand Iraqis who have died since the U.S. invasion, and according to people like Khaled Groenigut, that's an acceptable price to pay to protect ourselves and have security here in the United States. He goes on to say, when I was deployed to Iraq, I was assigned with my unit into the heat of the battle, the Anbar province, specifically Ramadi. We went into a city torn apart by war. Of course, it was torn apart by the fact that the United States invaded. With improvised explosive devices as prevalent on the streets as garbage. It's because, again, Iraqis are behaving in the way that Captain Moroni behaved, which was trying to kick out the invading armies. It says, Iraqis were afraid to walk around, and we couldn't believe that millions of people lived in the city. Okay, why were these Iraqis afraid to walk around while the U.S. military was in Ramadi? Well, let me read passage here.
Oh, shoot. Sorry.
This is from a soldier who was in Iraq named Phil Aleph. And I don't know if you guys know. I mean, hopefully, you know, maybe there are some people here in the room who have children or relatives who are serving as soldiers in Iraq. And number one, I have a lot of respect for those guys. Every day they go out, and women, they go out of their bases. They have snipers shooting at them. They have, you know, roadside bombs going off. Every day they wonder, is this going to be the day that I get an arm blown off, a leg blown off, or that I'm killed? And, of course, the way to support these troops is not to keep them in harm's way longer. It's to get them out of harm's way when they shouldn't be there in the first place. But there are a lot of veterans of the Iraq War who have come home and they realize that the war is wrong, and they've really been at the forefront of the anti-war movement ever since. And so this is from, again, a fellow named Phil Aleph, who's very active in Iraq Veterans Against the War. And this gives you an indication of why some of these Iraqis in Ramadi might have been scared to be walking around in the streets. And this fellow was actually here in Fallujah, which is a Sunni city very close to Ramadi in Anbar province, he said. He talked about a situation in which a roadside bomb went off near his convoy, he said. When the roadside bomb went off, our rules of engagement dictated for us to fire in every direction to draw out the trigger man so that we could shoot him down. As soon as the bomb went off, my squad leader, who was in front of the vehicle, was on the radio talking to our company headquarters. This sergeant in the back seat looks up at me and says, "Shoot that house right there on the right." Without even thinking about it, I shot about 300 rounds into the door of the house. Obviously, who knows who's in there, women, children, etc. After I finished shooting into the house, a white vehicle drove up at a high rate of speed. We engaged that vehicle and killed a young man who happened to be the Sheikh's son from the village we were operating in. We followed all the procedures that we were told to follow in that situation. We did not do anything wrong according to our chain of command. And I want to make that clear, that this was something that we didn't decide one day, that this was how we were going to operate. This was directly coming from our chain of command, from the Department of Defense, and from the administration about rules of engagement. And, you know, again, this is a soldier who is actively campaigning against the war. And I'm not sharing this to show that, oh, he was a bad guy, because you know what? Those guys were scared to death. Anywhere there could be, you know, they could get attacked from any place, from any particular Iraqi walking down the street. And they simply put an emphasis on protecting themselves and protecting their fellow soldiers, as opposed to putting an emphasis on protecting Iraqi civilians, because they're just trying to get out of the situation alive. So I'm not trying to blame the soldier, but I'm trying to say that the fact that he is in this situation and that President Bush and the Bush administration put them in that situation, that is the problem. Later, this soldier writing in this op-ed in the BYU newspaper says, "It is not our time to pull out and leave the country to fester and rot. So what if other countries hate us, spit at us, and despise us because of our involvement in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other countries? We are doing the right thing. Why pay attention to those who are in their great and spacious building?" So, again, we can't pull out and leave the country to fester and rot. Well, this is, I'm going to read a quote from the Washington Post. This is December 19, 2007. It says, "According to focus groups conducted for the U.S. military, Iraqis of all sectarian and ethnic groups believe that the U.S. military invasion is the primary root of the violent differences among them and see the departure of occupying forces as the key to national reconciliation." So you've got the army itself, the army's own researchers, saying that Iraqis of all sectarian and ethnic groups believe that the U.S. military invasion is the primary root of the violent differences between them and see the departure of occupying forces as the key to national reconciliation. There's this myth that Iraqis of different ethnic groups, Sunni, Shia, Kurd, that they've hated each other for generations and for centuries, and that that's why they're killing each other. That's not the case. It's not like it's not that there were never any sectarian tensions at all, but under Saddam's regime, that was, you know, people viewed themselves primarily as Iraqis. There's intermarriage between Sunni and Shia. It wasn't a big deal at all. When the U.S. invaded, they created the dynamic that caused the civil war that later ensued. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go into that whole process. Also, because I just wrote a long article about that in the Mormon Worker in this most recent edition. So again, I do have a couple in my backpack, and also there are some in the bookstore. But that is a myth that the United States is preventing civil war. In fact, the United States has caused a civil war, and Al-Qaeda, the presence of Al-Qaeda, has also contributed to that as well. So between the U.S. and Al-Qaeda, this is what's caused the civil war, and the Iraqis, both Sunni and Shia nationalists, have been trying so hard ever since the war began to keep that fabric of love and harmony and cooperation among the different ethnic groups. They've been trying to keep that alive. So the last thing, and then I'll sit down and let Bonner have some time, is he goes on to say that, let's see here. He says, other countries always talk about America like we are trying to spread some kind of imperial doctrine. Colin Powell answered this accusation with a single sentence. Over the years, the United States has sent many of its fine young men and women into great peril to fight for freedom beyond our borders. The only amount of land we have ever asked for in return is enough to bury those that did not return. Well, you know, Mr. Gonigut, there's a lot more to imperialism besides taking land. The United States is very happy to leave the sand to the Iraqis in Iraq. We're not happy to leave the oil to them. And I'll just go ahead and close my comments there.
Let me begin by stating my great respect for Will and the work that he has done. You didn't hear enough about his experience as he was kidnapped and what he went through and how he dealt with the kidnappers and then how he got out of it. You can read that story other places, but it's a very touching story. And contrasted with most of us who simply talk about these things, Will does something. He put himself on the line and attempted to bring peace to a very troubled world. And I appreciate that greatly. I'm not going to encourage him to do a lot more of the same thing. And I don't think Sterling would. But he keeps the process going in different ways. Let me offer an exclamation point to Will's position with my personal story, just very briefly. My involvement in the Middle East started when Howard W. Hunter invited me to go build bridges to the Palestinians in the Arab world in 89. And in the process of the discussion, he said that we had too many people who were belligerent, who were warmongers, and that we ought to adopt a different strategy. And he said at the time, let me read you a scripture, when he invited me to go to Palestine to build bridges. He said, let me read you a scripture. I just had cataract surgery, so I can't read very well, but he said, let me turn you to Isaiah chapter 19. I can quote this, but verse 23 to 25. It says, in that day, and President Hunter stopped and said, that day means a period of peace in the Middle East, and we must be part of creating that peace. In that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. And the Assyrians shall come to Egypt, and the Egyptians and Syria, and they will all work together. In that day Israel will be a third in the midst of the land with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of that land. And the Lord of hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, mine inheritance. He said that before the final days, there will be an extended period of peace in that world. This was in 1989, the height of the first Intifada, the uprising of the Palestinians against Palestinian structure and Israeli structure. And there was no prospects of peace. And he says there would be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. And if you know your geography, Israel sits between Egypt and Assyria. And President Hunter said, let me substitute Jordan for Assyria. Prophets have flexibility with the scriptures. He says, let me substitute Jordan for Assyria. He says, they will be connected. There will be economic and political and other mechanisms for trade and for building peace. In order to get from Egypt to Jordan, you have to go through Israel, and that was impossible when I would go between those two. And since that time, I've spent about 6 years living in Jordan or Jerusalem or Egypt, Syria, the Emirates. And it would take 2 days to go 50 miles. I would have to go from Jerusalem down to Eilat, and from Eilat across to Egypt into Nuebe, and then from Nuebe on a boat to Aqaba, and from Aqaba up to Amman. Took 2 days to go 50 miles. And so the prospects of moving directly across there were very slim. We don't negotiate with terrorists. Can you imagine how I felt 6 years later? Not that long. Four or five years later. As I stood on the border in Jordan, following a peace treaty negotiation between Israel and Jordan, and saw the bulldozers start to build a highway connecting Israel to Jordan. And my wife and I have traveled across that many times. In fact, Sterling and I went across that a few years ago. And there has been a stable peace between those three lands. The role of a peacemaker is to take a risk that frightened people won't take. And with President Hunter's encouragement, I took that risk, worked with the Palestinians, shot at four times, mainly by the Israelis, but worked hard to build a process that would allow negotiation rather than conflict. One day I was driving a BYU car that had Israeli license plates. Everybody's got a different color license plate. Israeli are yellow, and Palestinian are blue or green, commercial and private, and United Nations are white with the UN on it, and Gaza are silver, and the Israeli police are black, and the military are red. Everybody's got different color plates, so you immediately know who you're dealing with. And I had a car with yellow plates and accidentally drove through a Palestinian village and got stoned. The rocks started coming through the side of the car, and some severe damage to my arm and side of my head, and had a very good learning experience in the hospital. It was a great opportunity to make friends and build relationships. I went back to the village where I was stoned and told the village Mukhtar that I wanted to meet the people who had thrown the rocks. And at first he thought I was being vindictive, and I said, no, I just want to understand them. I want to know where they're coming from. Finally, he realized that I'd been doing a lot of things, building peace, and so he invited the four boys who had thrown the rocks to come. And we met, and we talked, and they said that the yellow license plate was a symbol of imposed violence and occupation on their land, and that they were very sorry that I was in the car because they liked me and appreciated what I was doing. But a line I'll never forget, but they said, but the car is the symbol of our enemy and it deserved to die. And you just happened to be in it. Well, we became friends, and one of those mornings when I had the 7 a.m. TWA flight out of Tel Aviv, had to be at the airport 3 hours early to go through security, had to leave Jerusalem at 2 o'clock, or 3 o'clock to get there, 4 o'clock. And as I went out of the Jerusalem center, here were these four boys with presents for me to take home to my family. You can make friends of terrorists, and you can negotiate, and you can build relationships if you care more about love than you care about dominance. Well, so President Hunter invited me to go. I've been, and you can make peace. And I've watched the Arab world over the last several years, and I agree with Will. The attitudes have become tragically destructive. The recruitment of terrorists in Gaza, in the West Bank, in many other countries, Syria and Lebanon, has been exacerbated dramatically by U.S. foreign policy. And the curious thing is, we say we want democracy, but when Gaza and the West, when Palestinians had democracy and elected a government of Hamas, we declared war on them. We don't want their kind of democracy, we want our kind of democracy. And that doesn't always fit the local culture. And so I would hope that we could be, as Will said, a little more open, a little more flexible, a little more willing to make peace and become children of God, as the Beatitudes say. And one last thing that President Henner gave me that I hope all of you are familiar with. If not, I encourage you to read his talk that he gave at a devotional at BYU called All Are Alike Unto God, where he said that as members of the Lord's Church, we need to change our perception. He said, we need to discover that all of God's children are heirs of promise, and that we should not take sides in the Middle East, that the Palestinians and the Arabs are as much the children of promise as the Jews. And the current creation of the State of Israel is not a fulfillment of prophecy, and that there will be an extended period of peace prior to the final days, and that we must be part of that. Our government behavior in most of those areas has not lended itself to that process. And I would hope that all of us could find a way to become peacemakers in a world of very tragic and troubled conflict, and in a world of biases and bigotry and hostility toward those who don't agree with our particular perspective. Thank you.
We have a few moments for a few minutes for questions. I would ask that you keep your comments to 1 or 2 minutes so that as many people as we can comment, but come up to the microphone.
William, maybe you could briefly tell us how you were kidnapped and how you got out as part of the thing. And my just comments in general I'll throw out there is that this war really is pathetic. In the 80s, we backed Saddam Hussein. Most people don't know that. We turned the other way while he gassed the Kurds. And we maybe justifiably said you're outnumbered 3-1 by the Iranians. They're going to wipe your whole country out. So use mustard gas on them. I think Rumsfeld practically told them to do it. And now it's the same Rumsfeld that all of a sudden says Hussein's getting too big for his bridges. He's double-crossed the Carlisle group. I'm not paying him for some weapon systems. And thinks it was Rumsfeld that pretty much orchestrated this whole mess. And he was the one that was helping Iraq against Iran 20 years ago. I mean, the hypocrisy is unbelievable.
Right, so if Saddam Hussein deserves to be hanged, so does Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Cheney. I mean, they really do. About the kidnapping, this was the second time I was in Iraq. I was in the northern Kurdish region, and, we were just driving. We had been visiting a village for about a week, and then on our way home, we were kind of driving through the desert, almost like you'd be driving between St. George and Vegas. And, some gunmen stopped our car and, just basically made one of the guys with the guns got in our car and made us follow another car full of gunmen out into the desert. And I was there for about nine days. And they said they were from a Sunni insurgent group from Saddam Hussein's old Ba'ath Party. It turns out they were probably Kurds, and they just wanted money. And bless my dad's heart, he managed to round up some cash and get me out. So I was only kidnapped for about 9 days, but it was a good experience. Meaning my comments earlier, I just kind of took the conflict from the perspective of Captain Moroni, because that's what most Mormons do. As soon as you start telling someone you're a pacifist, they just blow you off and say, "Well, Captain Moroni, you know." And so that's why I like to argue my points from, is from Captain Moroni's position. But, there was a time when, as we were, right after they abducted us, and I'd had another friend who worked for a Christian peacemaker team that I lived with for a couple months, who had been kidnapped and murdered. about a year before that. And there was this young kid in the car who, you know, who had the gun and was the abductor that actually got in our car. And I remember thinking, you know, if I had a gun right now, I could just really quick, because he looked scared. I mean, he had his gun, but he kept looking back at me because he probably thought, well, maybe this guy does have a gun. I mean, he didn't know. And if I had like a pistol on me of some sort, I could have just pulled it up real quick, shot him in the head, and we could have tried to escape or something like that. And that's what I was thinking, you know, at the time. Because I thought they were going to drive us out into the desert and basically just, you know, shoot us in the head and that'd be it. I mean, I thought I was going to be dead in a few minutes. And later on, I mean, I had to repent of that and realize that this young guy had, you know, a family and loved ones too. And I don't know why he was doing what he was doing, but whatever his reason was doesn't make it right. But, you know, it was a reminder to me that, you know, as Christians and as Mormons, even though there is all this fighting in the Book of Mormon and Captain Moroni did some good things to protect the Nephites, etc., I mean, you know, Jesus Christ is the one who we're supposed to emulate and follow, and Jesus was a pacifist. So that was a good lesson to me about, you know, having to love my enemies. You know, I just wish that we could apply that on more of a national level or as a on a church level. Why no one seems to care about the Sermon on the Mount, I'm not sure. It was mentioned in the New Testament and in the Book of Mormon. Why that gets ignored, or even people seem to hate it when you bring that up, I'm not really sure. But.
Yeah, this is actually going to be kind of related to what you're talking about. When most people, when we talk about wars, when we talk about the Book of Mormon, usually we want to say, well, what can we learn about this war from the Book of Mormon? And you took a little different twist on this, is, you know, you kind of showed, well, maybe the Lamanites here are, or the Nephites are more emblematic of the Iraqis and whatnot. But I think we might be able to turn this question around and ask ourselves, what can we learn about the Book of Mormon from these wars? And you made a sort of analogy or comparison. You said, well, the Book of Mormon, we have this Nephite perspective of the war. And you talked about, well, in America, we have an American perspective on our wars, and so we usually assume it's the same perspective. But is there anything I've learned over the last several years of studying American wars is that the American perspective of war is a perspective we often need to be most suspicious of and skeptical of. And I guess to take this further then, if we should be such suspicious of what our nations and what our people are telling us about our own wars, shouldn't we take that suspicion into the Book of Mormon and say, well, maybe we're getting this Nephite perspective of war, and maybe the Nephites are giving us their version, and maybe it's not all the version we're supposed to take. And we can even pull it even further and say, well, you know, this Nephite perspective, it has a stamp of approval from a warrior prophet, you know, Mormon. At the same time, we can say, well, our American wars have a stamp of approval from our American nationalist prophet, President Hinckley, who, you know, who gave his implicit support to this war as well. And so I guess my question is to you, is through your experiences, and for you, Bonner, as well, what has your view of the Book of Mormon and wars in the Book of Mormon changed from your experiences?
You know, I've thought about that a little bit. And here and there in the Book of Mormon, you do get a little bit of a Lamanite perspective between some of these letters that get exchanged between Captain Moroni, for example, and it was the brother of Malachi. I think it was Ammonihah, maybe. I forget his name. And so some of those arguments are a little bit like, you know, you could see that maybe the Lamanites, you know, instead of just being these barbarian, crazy terrorist people, that, you know, they might have had some reasons for doing what they did. Doesn't make it right, but, you know, at least it seems sensible to them. With the Book of Mormon in general, I mean, I think the overall message of it is, which comes from Mormon, is that, in fact, I have this written down on a quote here as well, is that when the last thing that Mormon writes to the Lamanites, before he's killed, is he writes like a message to the Lamanites, like, you know, that would just reach them in the future. And he just says two things. He says, lay down your weapons of war and stop the bloodshed. And he, you know, I'm sure he might have said that to the Nephites as well. In fact, he did when he condemned them for wanting to exterminate their enemies, the Lamanites. And he told them to repent and be baptized. That was it. That's all he told them. Put down your weapons of war and repent and be baptized and believe in Jesus. So, that, I think, is the message of the Book of Mormon right there. It's those two things. And in addition, not to seek after riches. I mean, there's a lot about money in there, too. But probably those two things, I mean, that's all. It's the only things the Book of Mormon really even talks about. So yeah, we should learn a lot from the Book of Mormon and be very skeptical of what our government does. And in fact, like I mentioned, there was this letter that this fellow wrote that I was reading to you guys, and I wrote a letter in response that the BYU newspaper published. And then right below mine, they published this letter, and I got to read it because, I mean, it'll probably, I don't know, it'll make you laugh, maybe it'll probably even make you cry. But this is what I would maybe call like the Hitler knows best syndrome. And so this was a letter that was published right below mine, you know, where I responded to that one about the Iraq War. It said, "I'm so sick and tired of people blaming President George W. Bush for the war in Iraq." Not really sure who else to blame. Probably Dick Cheney. That's probably accurate. Maybe Bush doesn't deserve so much blame. But it says, "Sure, I agree that we did go in there too fast, and that, to our knowledge, no weapons of mass destruction were found." She still can't believe it. Just to our knowledge. You know, they're probably there somewhere. Then she says, "However, this does not mean that Iraq was never in possession of such weapons. Does it ever occur to people that we, the people, do not know all of the information that the president or our representatives receive? That is why we have representatives. We delegate our decision-making power to our representatives, so the decisions can be made relatively quickly and effectively." And yeah, Hitler killed a lot of Jews really quick, really, really effectively and really quickly, and a lot of Germans didn't ask a lot of questions, and it's really no different today. I mean, there is really this kind of sympathy for fascism among a lot of members of the church that I don't know where it comes from, really. And they obviously wouldn't say we like Hitler or things like that, but their mode of thinking in terms of their view of authority and loving authority and trusting authority and wanting people in power to make decisions for them, it's really bizarre. But I just thought I had to mention that. So.
I will.
Oh, hey.
Do you read with your rhetoric today? Do you really? You said I believe. That's on the record. That's why I'm up here. You said I believe that Cheney and Bush deserve to be hung like Hussein.
Yes.
You said that. And do you believe that? Do you also believe in making a rhetorical analogy to fascism and to Hitler is rhetorically useful when you're making a claim that those people who appeal to all authority must therefore, it seems, be fascists and mindlessly going toward Hitler? I know how passionate you are about these things, but since it's on the record, I think your rhetoric needs to be somehow explained a little bit here. So, especially in line of the only thing that matters is repentance and laying down your weapons and loving each other and treating your enemies with love and care in a way that's going to change their hearts. You know, lay down in front and die so that they might be changed. I'm not saying to do that. I'm just saying there's a complexity of rhetoric that you're just bringing me to address today. So you know what to do, and I wanted to address it.
No, sure. Those are great questions, and you know, maybe there's someone in the FBI in the crowd, and in that case, I appreciate you making me clarify what I'm saying.
I was against the war.
But what I said with regards to Dick Cheney and President Bush Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld deserving to be hanged, that is, if Saddam Hussein deserved to be hanged, then Rumsfeld and Cheney deserved to be hanged because they assisted and helped Saddam at a time when he was committing his worst atrocities against especially the Kurds, but also against other Iraqis. Personally, again, being a pacifist, I don't think Saddam Hussein should have been hanged. I mean, I don't think retribution and doing that, I don't think that's the way to do it. I mean, I'm against the death penalty. I just think it's wrong to do that. I think that, again, if we use Jesus as our guide, you know, we should be pacifists. And yeah, you know, if someone breaks into your house and is about to kill your wife, I'm not going to give you a hard time. You know, Palestinians who are fighting against the Israeli military, I would never condemn them for doing what they're doing. But, you know, if, like most Americans think, Saddam Hussein deserved to be killed, then, you know, by extension, so does Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. And on the other thing about fascism, are there people at BYU who are sympathetic to Hitler? No. Does this girl, bless her heart, you know, in fact, it's probably mean of me to kind of make fun of her. I shouldn't have done that. But I'm just saying that it's this mode of thinking that is really damaging and destructive, this trust for authority that, you know, leave it up to the leaders because they're the ones that know best. That doesn't constitute fascism just because you think that, but that is moving in that direction. And that's very different from the way we should be thinking as a, you know, if we're living in a democracy, you know, we should say, you know what, the people have the ability to make their own choices and to make informed choices. So we want to know everything our leaders are doing to make sure that, you know, it really is moral and it really is just. And again, in the Book of Mormon, there's all kinds of warnings against, you know, people abusing power and so on and so forth. So, yeah, I appreciate the question and sorry to you know, that was a little bit misleading what I said earlier. So,
one last quick question.
A quick comment, Bill. You seem surprised to find that Latter-day Saints treat their political leaders with so much deference and with so much trust. I would propose that it's not so bizarre at all. What's happening is that Latter-day Saints are treating their political leaders with the very same degree of deference that they're taught to treat their ecclesiastical leaders.
I probably agree with that. And you know, being a believing Mormon, I love the church. You know, President Monson, I love that guy. And so I respect him as the prophet. And on religious matters, I respect what he says and what he thinks is right. But you're right. And there are other people who would argue, you know, we shouldn't even feel that way about general authorities. I happen to feel that way. Bless his heart, I think President Monson is a great guy. But definitely, yeah, you can't treat politicians that same way. And I remember when the war did break out, I remember people saying that all the time. You know, well, President Bush is an inspired man. He prays. And so they were just, you know, very, very willing to trust him. So that's something that we really need to do better in the church, is distinguish between religious authority, political authority.
This is the end now of session 363, Mormons and the Iraq War. Thank you all for coming.